Good morning. A decision about holding the state in contempt regarding the Na'iopuni election is on today's Supreme Court schedule. The case brought by Conservative Foundation Judicial Watch and local organization Grassroots Institute is on our agenda, too, with Grassroots President Kaylee Akina. Help for Hawaii's low-income workers is again on the calendar in the form of another push for a state-earned income tax credit. Victor Gemignani of the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice details their latest report. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. We'll look at designs for the living spaces around us in the newly opened 6th Annual Kagu Akari Exhibition. And an exhibition at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center invites printmakers from around the country to weigh in with statements on nature.
It's Friday, January 15th. The conversation starts right after this news.
Can come, here I come, because weekends were made for fun.
Oh, there goes the conversation crew again. It must be a weekend. It's a Friday at least. Yeah, we can watch them through the glass there. Well, hope you enjoyed that too. And good morning and welcome to the conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
A decision day today.
It is a decision day today, and we're going to talk about that in our very, very first conversation. Now, remember that when last we left it, the Grassroots Institute was celebrating a victory. In early December, you might remember, the Supreme Court had agreed that the counting of ballots or certification of results in the Na'iopuni election should stop. Now, that motion was granted pending the outcome of an appeal of the Ninth Circuit Court. Today, though, the Supreme Court is considering the original motion to hold the state in contempt. As the Grassroots Institute waits for its decision, its president, Kaylee Akina, is in our studio this morning. Thanks for being here.
Well, Aloha Friday, Beth Ann. Great to be here with you.
Well, it could turn out to be a good Aloha Friday to you, but already it's now well into the afternoon. Have you had any conversation yet or any decision yet?
No word yet, but the United States Supreme Court agreed today to listen to our motion that the state of Hawaii, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, and Na'iopuni were disrespecting their order. And their order was basically, as you said, let's stop the race-based election and process, and yet they found a way to try to get around that.
Let's take people on a timeline, because this is a very complex issue and you sort of have, you know, cases and motions within
That's
each other.
Right.
So going back to the beginning, the original motion was to hold that this was unconstitutional.
That's right. We have two suits. The first suit was simply to say that we have no problem with Native Hawaiians, and I'm one, organizing, but when the state government uses state resources to set up a race-based system, that's not good. So we went here to the First Circuit Court in Hawaii, and we lost. But we appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court, and the Ninth Circuit Court is now in San Francisco waiting to hear that case.
The second case, though, came
yes.
up with the injunction itself.
That's right. So we decided to go back to court and say, since millions of dollars are going to be wasted on this process until the Ninth Circuit hears it, we asked the court to give a temporary injunction and to say, stop spending that money and quit proceeding in that direction. We lost at the First Circuit here in Hawaii, but we went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court, right after Thanksgiving, told the state of Hawaii and the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, you have to stop this process. You cannot count those ballots. You need to set aside this process of using state-funded resources.
Yet we watched as Na'iopuni went forward with that, at least for a couple more weeks.
Right. The first maneuver they did was first acknowledging that they had to stop the process, but then saying the Supreme Court didn't prevent them from adding another 3 weeks to the election. So they went forward with that. And then strangely, at the end of the second week, they decided to use another tactic, which is to cancel the election completely and seat all of the people who were running for office in a state constitutional convention to establish a sovereign Hawaiian nation.
Now, they've also said that that what you've been doing is to try to stop them from having that gathering.
Well, you know, that there's no truth to that whatsoever. There has always been the opportunity to bring people together to discuss a potential Hawaiian solution to sovereignty. And that has been taking place in large measure with many groups. It can take place in the future. All we're saying, and it's very specific, is that the state of Hawaii cannot use public resources for a race-based process.
How much of a breach and real, you know, chasm has this whole adventure caused within the Hawaiian community as you see it?
Well, it's an interesting thing, Beth Ann. The Hawaiian community is split in terms of those who want to seek some form of sovereignty sponsored by the government, such as federal recognition, remember the old Akaka bill, and those who don't want to see any kind of involvement of the government whatsoever, whether that be federal or state. Yet another group has emerged, and Grassroots Institute is very gratified for this. Many independence activists, many Hawaiian groups are supporting our work, saying we need to preserve the aloha spirit. And even as Hawaiians move forward, we have never been racially discriminatory. We've been very inclusive. And that voice has started to emerge now.
And then how do you look at the issue of the Department of the Interior's proposal, which is, you know, beyond the Akaka
right.
bill, this is sort of saying that this is not necessarily flowing out of what may happen now, but if it's not put into place according to those who support it now, then that might not, or that might preclude it happening later when an administration will change.
Well, this is where I have to sympathize with anybody who's new to this issue. It is a little confusing. There's something going on in the background that you allude to, and that is, quite apart from what our state is doing, the federal government, through the Department of Interior, is looking at changing its rules so it can acknowledge a Native Hawaiian governing entity. And this is quite apart from what's going on in our state. That's proceeding right now, and we are actually trying to stop that, because the bottom line is this: Native Hawaiians have never been an Indian tribe. We are not defined on the basis of race, and we don't have a continuing form of government. And Hawaiians have no consensus in terms of wanting to become an Indian tribe.
That's the big bone of contention, though, that term Indian tribe.
That's
and
right.
That's not really, if you listen to what we hear come out of the Department of Interior, looking at it as an Indian tribe, but looking at it to form a government-to-government relationship with Native Hawaiians. That sounds to be a different situation than what seemed to be the big sticking point, which is the way we saw the Akaka bill play out, because of what you just mentioned, people looking at it, you know, was it being looked at like an Indian tribe, a Native American tribe? With all of this spinning around, is there any hope in your mind for any coalescence within the Native Hawaiian communities, which seem to be so very split now?
Well, I think something that's going to help bring people together is eliminating some of the strange options that have come up. So when the courts rule, and we think they will rule, to stop the state government, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, and Na'iapuni from proceeding with their election and their convention, one option is eliminated. When the federal government stops its process of insisting upon some kind of government-to-government relationship with Hawaiians, that will eliminate another process. And then what will emerge is a community of people who will go forward with more realistic solutions, more focused on education, economics, and really how we can all live together into the rest of the 21st century and beyond.
When you talk about, you know, living together, there are some who really do want to have that government-to-government relationship and want to see that recognition.
Every poll taken so far, including the process of signing people up for the Native Hawaiian role, has shown that the vast majority of Native Hawaiians actually don't want a separate government.
So it'll be very interesting to see how any sort of reconciliation goes forward. But first of all, we'll wait and see what happens later today as we hear from the Supreme Court. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, and thank you for letting us speak to preserve the aloha spirit.
Dr. Akeli Akina is President and CEO of the Grassroots Institute of Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. It is 8:13, and coming up in the show, shedding light on the world of furniture design. But first, your quiz.
So, okay, it's a Friday, and we're lacing up our hiking boots as today's backyard quiz takes us to the island of Kauai in search of a picturesque landmark. Now, millions of years ago, volcanic eruptions created basalt over which a 151-foot waterfall now cascades. Below the ridge, you can see the vertical dikes of basalt cutting through the horizontal Koloa lava flows. This waterfall gets its name from the freshwater shrimp that were once plentiful in the Wailoa stream and which would tumble down into the rolling water beneath. Now, the waterfall flows year-round, usually in a double cascade, but after a heavy rain, the two sides often merge into one powerful gravitational plunge to a pool of water that's inaccessible to hikers, unless you know the secret trails. So, what's the name of this waterfall? The answer is coming up in just a few conversations, but if you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get the right answer gets a t-shirt.
Good morning, I'm Mark Prados from the band Mark Prados and His Enablers. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR 2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The way we arrange our interior spaces can affect the way we go through our day, even if most of the time we're not aware of it. Here in Hawaii, generations of artisans have created a distinctive approach to furniture and luminary design that reflects a specifically local aesthetic, one that's currently on display at Fish Cake in Kaka'ako, the 6th annual Kagu Akari exhibition, which combines the work of established designers with that of students from the University of Hawaii Manoa's School of Architecture Furniture Elective. Naomi Taga has put the show together. She's with us this morning. Good morning, Naomi.
Morning, Chris and Ben.
Do you agree with that description of furniture design as a sort of an unnoticed art?
Oh, definitely. And I think Kagu Akari, which actually has been curated by Keiko Hatano, our gallery curator, alongside Mara Fujihira, the co-owner of Fish Cake. But it does kind of percolate the question of, well, what is art and what is product? And I think the show beautifully straddles both lines. If you go into the show, it does look like an art show, but these are pieces that you can use in your everyday lives.
When does a chair become a work of art, right?
I think, it begs the question of, well, how do we choose to consume these products? You know, who is it made by? Does the design kind of inspire you? Does it make you want to work better, work harder? Or, you know, how does it affect your living space and then your mindset?
Well, because I think that one's mindset is very much affected by the physical space around it. And yet a lot of us don't really do anything about that. You know, you might live among clutter, or you might have a design around you, designs around you that don't really reflect where your mind wants to go, yeah?
Yeah, Chris, we kind of were joking outside a bit of how the Hawaii home, Hawaii in quotes, is aspirational, and people try to communicate that design, whether it's through art or products, and sometimes it manifests in dolphins and beaches, which is beautiful, you know, but that's...
Interiors that communicate a love of the outdoors, a love of the islands, that kind of thing.
But I think what Fishcake does beautifully is try to offer something different, a different vision. That is, ask, well, what is Hawaii and what does that look like, or what do you want it to look like?
And the starting point for that, Naomi, was I was saying I'm in a lot of homes where you see a painting of the ocean and then you look out of the window and there's the ocean.
Right.
And it's sort of, you're not really providing a contrast to the world around you. Sort of a, it's almost like a poor man's copy of the world around you.
Right, right. And do we have to be so literal? Does it have to be an ocean, or can the ocean be inspiration for something else?
There you go.
Yeah.
So this is obviously more to the level of the inspirational, as you were saying, the kind of work that you have on display.
Yeah, for sure. We have this concept at Fishcake of living with art, and we offer product from, you know, the larger furniture to the small piece that you put in your bathroom even. In addition, one of the functions of our space is to offer an art gallery. And so, you know, it goes to the idea that it is one thing and one purpose, of course, to see wall art on four white walls. Mm-hmm. As you would in a commercial gallery setting, and completely another to experience it as if you were living with it every day in your home.
Which is not quite as the sort of the sterility, if you will, of a gallery.
Exactly.
Presentation.
It's that emotional relationship that you can build. Mm-hmm. And seeing it manifested in our gallery is... everything.
Well, you know, you see a beautifully designed chair in a gallery setting, you know, with a beautiful shape and things like that, and that doesn't quite tell you what it's going to look like in front of the TV with a shirt hanging from one arm or something, which is actually what it's going to be represented as in your daily life, right?
Yeah, but again, can it be something different? Can it be a spark for an idea, or, you know, a lifestyle or a mindset? It doesn't just have to be something you sit on. Mm-hmm. It can be something that also, asks a little more, inspires, perhaps.
Well, in a gallery setting or even in a showroom setting, one of the things that's very important is having a lot of space around the object so that the object can be appreciated, right? And one of the aspects of interior design is how much is just open space in a room? How much of the room does furniture take up? In earlier generations, furniture just took up everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go inside a 19th century home and there's no light, there's no air going through by comparison with today's home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the space in the non-space is very important. Maybe... some would say contemporary is minimalism too. It's harking back to like simpler times and editing.
Are you able to see trends year in and year out in design, Naomi, with the things that come through your space?
Trends for sure, but we also try to refrain from trends and just let things happen organically. And that is inspired by its people, Hawaii.
Sure.
Issues that we are observing, things that, you know, spark us. And we're more interested in addressing that than trends. What are our own ideas?
Well, but you do see, I would think that you see some pattern in how designers react to space, use space, use different materials, that kind of thing.
Yes, and I think when they walk into our space, there's something that is created from the tangible, and that's almost the intangible. It's feeling, and they're like, wow, this is an amazing space. Why? Because it's different, and it's almost not of the trend.
Sure. Well, when you walk into a space that's very well designed, you don't necessarily know why it's having the effect it's having, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's almost too ethereal. I can't say why. Some people have said it's feng shui or...
Well, there's something that happens. We might not be able to define it all that well, but there's something that happens.
Yeah, it's a curation for sure.
There you go. Thanks very much for coming in, Naomi.
Thank you.
Naomi Targa is one of the coordinators of the 6th Annual Kagu Akari Exhibition, which runs from January 14th to March 6th at Fish Cake on Kamani Street in Honolulu's Kaka'ako District.
When a baby enters the world, it's greeted by a welcoming committee of bacteria. I'm Manoush Samarodi. Join me on Science Friday for a look at the microbiome of babies. Plus, engineers have cooked up a new recipe for making concrete on Mars. That's on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
On the street where you live, Nielsen research tells us that it's likely that one in eight of your neighbors listens to HPR each week. And some of them have gone beyond merely listening and, with their financial support, have made our service available for the rest of the community. Please join us in thanking these Neighbor Island members, Paulette Bertner of Waimea, Renee Beal and David Vest of Kaunakukai, and Michael and Nora O'Frell of Pahoa. You too can do the neighborly thing and become an HPR member by donating and calling us at 955-8821 during business hours, or go online and donate there at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting the new Shanghai Circus featuring acrobats, jugglers, balance artists, and contortionists, January 18th and 19th in Castle Theater. Tickets at mauiarts.org.
How do you save tourist lives without scaring tourists away? That's the question Civil Beat considers in the wrap-up to its series Dying for Vacation. And our last reality check of the week, reporter Chad Blair joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Friday, Beth.
Yeah, you too. Now, it all comes down to this question with everything that we've talked about this week. How do you make sure that tourists stay safe and know what that means and where they could possibly run into trouble and not, you know, sort of put the don't come here sign up for tourists to experience maybe even before they even decide to come to Hawaii? How do you do that?
Some of the people, yeah, it's a balance. That's what Nathan Eagle, the essential message that's coming across in his story today, that there has to be a balance between Hawaii is this ideal tourist destination where people want to go and do lots of things, and yet it's also got to be a safe place. I mean, you know, you can't possibly control everybody's behavior, especially in this internet world where people, you know, use GoPros, they're on YouTube, they're taking selfies, they're using social media. In many ways, the internet has really fueled a lot of this adventurism that's getting people into trouble and causing them to die while they're here. But the things that Nathan was hearing are things like this. We could use some more lifeguards. There could be more warning signs around the state. More accountability from guidebooks. It's the guidebooks, many of them, that are sending these tourists into places they really shouldn't go. And then maybe some more leadership from our elected officials.
Meanwhile, you know, we have various different stories and cases that have come out of people who have unfortunately died here. The one that opens up the Dying for Vacation wrap-up today is the one about of Jamie Zimmerman, who was a doctor and journalist from ABC, and we remember that happening last fall.
That's right, and her mother has really taken on a campaign, posting things on the internet, contacting officials saying, look, my My daughter would not have died had there been more warnings at this beach on Kauai. She's not the only one. There are other people that have lost loved ones that are really taking a grassroots effort here to try and get people to be aware of the dangers that do come with Hawaii. And as we pointed out all week long, drowning in particular is the most serious problem, the highest rates of casualties from visitors.
What about showing videos to tourists? I mean, that idea has come up time and time again. There used
it
to
has.
Be some, again, being explored now, just, you know, not to scare the pants off of them, but to say you've got to be also very responsible for your own safety in places that
right.
may look fairly benign.
You will see some videos in the bag carousels at the Kauai and Maui airports, but are people really looking at those videos, or are they looking for their bags? You know, that's the problem. And then what about a video that's on an airplane as you're coming to Hawaii? Well, the airlines have been reluctant to do that, to show, if you will, images that might scare people off. Don't go swimming in the ocean. You also wonder whether the videos are tough enough. You remember those ads about what crack does and how it shows
right.
people's faces and teeth and so forth? Imagine if they had that kind of equivalent for ocean safety. That might make people sort of say, well, gee, I better be careful when I go to the beach.
All right. It's obvious that reaching this balance is difficult, but clearly that's this campaign has to continue given the number of people we've talked about this week who have unfortunately died while they've been here on vacation. Thanks, Chad.
Thank you. See you Monday.
You betcha. Holiday or not, we'll be here. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat. One of the things we like to do on a Friday is to get a preview of what's coming out of our newsroom in the coming week. And to do that, HPR News Director Bill Dorman is here to do just that. Thanks very much. Good morning.
Good morning,
the big
Beth.
News. Yeah, we know the big news. Next Wednesday, Ledge opens.
Exactly. You know, everybody's been teeing up on this. We've already been having money arguments. We're going to be having money arguments for months. But it's a good chance to actually sort of pull back the lens a little bit and look at the basic questions as a democratic society. How do we choose to use our resources? Where do we direct our resources? How do we spend our money? That's just going to be part of what Wayne Yoshioka's week is going to be about next week. As you know, Ledge gets underway, and we'll see. We're off to the races from there.
We certainly are, and we'll be having a field trip down there, a bunch of us, on Wednesday, too. Beyond that, though, we've got lots happening of saw Nainoa Thompson here yesterday as he was being interviewed for a national show. Hokulea very much on our minds.
Yeah, exactly. Making its way across the Atlantic now. How odd does that sound? But, you know, I mean, you know that's part of the global voyage, but of course you associate Hokulea with Pacific. But they have been around the Cape of Good Hope some time in South Africa, now making their way across the Atlantic, eventually reaching Brazil. Just left the island of St. Helena, and Molly Solomon will be having an update on their more precise locations and doings next week.
That's going to be good fun. They're going to get to hang out in Brazil for a little bit of time, aren't they?
I suspect they will, yes.
Noe Tanegawa was recently in Palau.
Yeah, this is fascinating. So Noe went to Palau and on an art project and did some radio work there and spoke with a wide cross-section of people, teacher, bus driver, the Minister of Culture, putting together information about history and a look ahead to elections this year in Palau. And also sort of an introduction for folks who may not be as familiar with what is a vibrant and different culture in Palau that has survived over times and that has had various influences, again, on the Pacific Island front, as so many of our Pacific neighbors do. But Noe gets a firsthand look at that, so we'll be hearing from her all next week on that.
And I've heard tell that there's going to be a little something about Kenny G coming up, too. Is that
you
true?
Know,
who's coming
to
the Blue Note?
So Kenny G is kicking off the Blue Note, and there are all kinds of facts you may not know. First played professionally when he was in high school, and Barry White was in Seattle. Barry White, sax player, somehow went missing. Kenny G's high school music teacher recommended him for the slot, and projects developed from there. Also flies planes, lands on mountain lakes, and if you've ever been in Beijing on the subway, you may have heard Kenny G music, and Dave Lawrence will tell you why. That's this afternoon interview on HPR 1 on All Things Considered.
All right, even before we get to next week, lots of good things coming out of Dave Lawrence later on today about Kenny G. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Good way to start a weekend. News director Bill Dorman joins us every Friday with a preview of coming attractions from the news department, and obviously a little bit more about what we may see later on today, too. In Hawaii, the average hourly wage of a renter is $14.49. According to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition State Housing Profile, a worker would have to make $31.54 an hour to afford a two-bedroom apartment. Big disconnect. For low-wage workers, some help comes in the form of a federal earned income tax credit. To help more, the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice has long said Hawaii's low-income workers also need a refundable state earned income tax credit. Hawaii Appleseed is again making that point in a report published this week, and Executive Director Victor Gemignani joins us now. Good morning. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
In some ways, this conversation will be very reminiscent of other conversations that we've had, because you've said for a very long time that this is happening at the federal level with the earned income tax credit. Why don't we have one in Hawaii? Anyone better able to listen now that the report is out this year?
Well, I think so, because a number of factors are coming together in our community. I mean, Bill Dorman just mentioned in the last segment that the legislature is about to open, and that's a time when we really set priorities in our state. How do we spend the precious resources and the limited resources we have? So the bottom line is there are a couple of factors that are coming together, I think, that are going to make a conversation more fertile and more relevant around earned income tax credit. The first is obviously the affordability of housing, and you mentioned that. The second, of course, is the homeless crisis that we have in our state, which is driving much of our politics in the legislature right now. In order to resolve the problems you have in affordable housing and the problems you have in terms of homelessness, you've got to do two things. The first thing you've got to do is get on the supply side of affordable housing. We all recognize that. And there's a whole variety of models that have now been introduced over the last 2 years, ADUs and micro units being two examples, that can dramatically expand the availability of housing in our state if our leaders make the right choices. But the second part of the equation is just as important. You've got to get money in the pockets of low-income wage earners so that allow them to be able to afford the incredible rents that they have to pay today.
The people who are renting right now.
Right now. The problem you have is you have a scarcity of affordable rental housing. You have 20,000 units that are necessary right now. And even given Governor Ige's significant apparent attempt to put about $100 million or more into affordable housing, you're not going to create that many real units when you take a look at what that money's going to buy. So we have a tremendous deficit we have to dig ourselves out of in terms of the housing supply. And the people that obviously are close to the edge, low-income wage earners that don't have a lot of savings and can, in fact, save because of the economics of their life, if they ever run into a problem of stress, of loss of jobs, of disability, of a fracturing in the family, of a variety of different things, they could be very easily out in the street because they just can't afford the current housing in terms of the price that goes for it. So you've got to deal with the money in the low-income wage earners' pockets. And just one thing. Statistics. Not only do we have the highest cost of living in the United States and the highest cost of shelter in the United States, we all share that burden. We also pay the lowest wages in the United States when you factor in cost of living. So low-income wage earners are confronted not only with incredibly high costs, but also very low wages that they're paid. So you've got to do something about it. And the EITC is particularly tailored to do exactly what has to be done, get more money immediately into the pockets of low-income wage earners in an efficient and effective means using tax relief.
With everything that you've just said, and we've had other conversations about this too, looking at why doesn't the state want to put this same thing in that one can get from the federal government, why? Why do you see that this seems to be still the argument and the conversation?
Well, I think people on the low side of the wage scale do not actively participate in the political process. They are not, their voices are very seldom heard, and unfortunately many of them don't vote, and politicians listen to votes. I'll give you a classic example that just occurred in the last legislative session, which I personally think is a tragedy. We made a decision in this legislature, the last legislative session, 215, to stop the taxes on the high rollers in the state, those that are the various wealthy in the state of Hawaii that was implemented in 2009 as a response to the recession. That's $48 million we decided to return to the various wealthy in the community. And by the way, 93% of that $48 million goes to the top 1% earners in this state. So the Democratic or the legislature made a decision for a variety of reasons, maybe good, maybe bad, to ultimately provide a tax relief, a significant tax relief to the highest rollers we have in their state. They ought to be doing the same thing for the people at the bottom, the middle class, because the lower and moderate income population of the state pays around 13 cents for every dollar they earn in taxes, primarily because of the GET. It's such a regressive tax. The people at the very top end pay about 7 cents out of every dollar, about half of what the low and moderate income residents pay. And by the way, we are the second to third worst state in the United States in terms of taxing people living in low and moderate wages. So I think it's time, to be frank, for the leadership to ultimately to say, not only are we going to help those in the top end of the scale, which they may or may not decide are needy, but certainly the ones that are struggling on a day-to-day basis and confront our major problem that we have to confront in the community, the ability to afford housing and the ability to avoid the streets and the cost and the family destruction that happens when someone lands in the streets from homelessness.
Victor, we talk a lot about caring for those most in need. We talk a lot about families and about the aloha spirit. We talk about a lot about those things that seem not to sync well with some of the realities that you just talked about. Are we too based in the sort of the mythological idea of how we conduct ourselves in Hawaii, and we don't really take very good care of those who are the most in need?
Well, I think we started out in the 50s and 60s, 59 when we became a state and expanded in the 60s and 70s, with a really great record of progressivity. But over the last 30 years, we've lost it, and I think there are a lot of different reasons for that. Access, obviously, to power has been more centralized among those that have wealth. But more importantly, I think in the 60s and 70s, most of us had people that lived on the plantations and remember what it was like to be ultimately raised in poverty. And struggling if you're a low-income wage earner. I think a lot of ways our leaders have evolved from that sensitivity and understanding and support for those that are really struggling in our community and now concentrating on different priorities that may be necessary. I'm not going to suggest that the problems or the decisions we have to make are easy. They're incredibly difficult to make because our elected officials have to balance a lot of different needs and a lot of different demands and a lot of different people that are coming to them for different types of support. I would just suggest that if we're going to solve our core problems that we all acknowledge are core problems in our state, homelessness, income inequality, and the ability to survive for the low and moderate income, you've got to go to serious tax relief because that's where the money is, and that's the easiest, most efficient way you can ultimately resolve part of the problems in terms of people struggling.
By putting more money
into
the pockets of the people who most need it.
Immediately.
We'll see what happens this time around. Yeah. Thanks for the report this year.
Thank you so much.
Victor Geminiani is the Executive Director of the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. It has just released its report on the earned income tax credit that they are suggesting Hawaii adopt.
Ciao. I'm Ben Soda from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue this conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Earlier in the show, we asked you the name of a waterfall located in the Waialua River State Park on the eastern side of the island of Kauai. It's a spectacular 151-foot waterfall whose name comes from Hawaii's native freshwater shrimp. Most of them know these shrimp as opai, and if you know the Hawaiian word for rolling, you've probably got the answer to today's quiz. Opai Ka'a Falls is the place we're looking for. And our listener who submitted the quiz said one of the best times to see these falls is in full sunlight when the water sparkles. Maybe you'll even catch a glimpse of the little opai. Thanks to our anonymous listener for this one.
Who obviously knows the secret trails to get there to be able to see some of this stuff too. But Daryl Miyasato called in from Lihue, also knew the name, and will be receiving the t-shirt. It's now 8:46. That's today's quiz. And if you have one for us, like our anonymous listener who sent in this one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, announcing their annual Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations, February 1st through 4th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
This is an exciting time to be a printmaker. The artist's palette is being expanded by new tech-based tools, even as the work remains anchored in techniques that go back centuries. Charles Cohan teaches printmaking at UH Manoa and keeps an eye on new developments in his craft, many of which are currently on display in an exhibition at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, where Charlie and several of his peers from around the country make their statements on the natural world. He's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Are you finding there more and more basically computer-based techniques that can be integrated into older techniques in your work?
Well, I think the range of contemporary printmaking, kind of the expansion of the definition, you're bringing in 3D printing these days, CNC cutting, CAD programming, and these are integrating within more of the kind of traditional kind of foundation techniques of the medium.
What's CAD programming?
Computer numerical control. Excuse me. CAD programming is computer assisted design, and CNC cutting is a computer numerical control system where you can computer program cutting heads, similar to just an extension of the hand and the cutting motion with a traditional tool, but in a computer based language.
And then 3D printing essentially allows you to make a dimensional version of something that you can envision on a computer, right?
Yes, yeah, and it certainly found its place within kind of sculptural practices, but it has really extended into printmaking in kind of a contemporary definition, and so printmaking as we traditionally knew it as a two-dimensional medium has now very fluidly kind of reached into the three-dimensional realm as well.
One of the things that's interesting to me, Charlie, about the new techniques integrated with old techniques is obviously, these new techniques work very fast, among other things.
Yeah, there's certainly, there's something to say for speed and efficiency, and traditional printmaking techniques are renowned for being fairly slow and labor-intensive. So it's an interesting kind of space between kind of the speed of contemporary technology and yet still an appreciation for the slow, kind of more kind of practice methods of traditional making.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking about, Charlie, because there definitely is a value to the slow methods in that they're very considered methods.
Yeah, and it's interesting kind of within our contemporary world the there's kind of a visible reappreciation of the kind of slow, laborious techniques in the face of all the speed and efficiency of contemporary technologies. And certain aspects, I'll just mention, say, traditional book arts and hand letterpress printing, which have really experienced a revival over the past 15 and 20 years in the face of all of this new and speedy technology.
Well, maybe the downside of speedy technology is that if you're not careful, it can be a little superficial.
It can be. It can also be very easily replicated, and so losing a sense of authenticity and identity of the individual maker.
Well, that definitely seems to be eroding in the contemporary art world. The whole idea of originality and authenticity.
And it's something definitely that's being re-questioned within these new developing technologies.
Mm-hmm. How are they reflected in this show? Statements on nature. Now you're implying these techniques to make comments on the natural world.
Yeah, the exhibition, it features eight artists whose work is basically investigating both traditional and non-traditional techniques. And that extends into the way in which nature kind of as a base kind of foundation for the exhibition. Because the artists, it's a range of artists looking at both the natural world as we kind of refer to it in kind of a natural state of the environment, but also the kind of landscapes of cultural and political and social constructs as well. So the notion of nature is kind of an extended definition in this respect.
Sure, because you have work here that addresses things like invasive species, climate change,
deforestation, but also work that investigates kind of a social deterioration and kind of personal issues within that.
How do you translate that into you? How do you make a comment on that in your medium? How does that translate into the work?
My own personal work for this exhibition is a series of large-scale, all hand-cut woodcuts, which are, as we previously mentioned, very laborious, very time-consuming. Mm-hmm. And there's a subtle reference in my work in this particular piece regarding deforestation, regarding invasive species, regarding kind of the very short lifespan of certain aspects of the physical natural environment. So I try to, in this particular work, to kind of link the slow, laborious process to kind of the time considerations of the natural environment and of, particularly in this case, kind of horticultural species.
Because your work refers to a grove of black cherry trees, huh?
Yes, which are a non-native species in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. Mm-hmm. And these are trees that were actually transported from the southeastern part of the country in the kind of early mid-1920s and have been a stand or grove on this individual piece of property that my family has actually owned for the last 40 years. So we basically observed kind of the state of the natural landscape through the degrading state of this particular stand of non-native invasive, basically invasive species.
So it didn't thrive in a new environment?
No, it didn't. They were healthy through the 1970s and 80s when I was kind of growing up on adjacent to this landscape. But in the past 10 years, they have contacted a blight, and they recently kind of reached the point at which they all had to be cut down. So my particular piece is basically a kind of a personal kind of memoir, personal memorial to this particular grove of trees and what it has represented in terms of the natural landscape and my family's identity in relating to this particular piece of property.
Because it was a place of your childhood as well.
It was a place that I kind of grew up on. Mm-hmm. It was a family property that was primarily used kind of in the spring, summer, and autumn months. And it's a place that my mother, who's now elderly, spent many of the last years of her life. And the tree for me kind of represents her view and her vision of this particular land and its ever-changing condition.
Well, that's also an example of how a natural setting can very much take on the character of the people who inhabit it. Yeah,
absolutely, and reflect in a subliminal manner that reflect the changes that those individuals are experiencing as well.
I called you last night at your studio, and I got the definite impression of a bustling environment. Is that what
reached me at the UH Manoa printmaking studio, which at the time you called, we were right between classes shifting, so it's a group studio. It's an open access student environment, I think you caught it in a fairly noisy and bustling moment.
I thought it was great, Charlie, because it goes against the stereotype of the artist in his lonely garret. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very much tied to printmaking, and there are certain forms, I think, printmaking, the glass arts, ceramics, certainly metalsmiths can understand as well, that it's not always possible to maintain your own personal individual studio. So many of these forms, printmaking I think especially included, they're collaborative studios, they're cooperative working environments where you don't work as a solo, isolate artist on your own. You are working in a community that is using the space collaboratively, cooperatively, and in a shared spirit.
Well, I thought it was kind of nice. Thanks very much for talking with us, Charlie.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Charles Cohen is a professor of art and printmaking program chair at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He's the co-curator of Statements on Nature, a survey of printmaking today at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's Schaefer International Gallery. The show runs until March 13th, and you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
All Things Considered has been there through war.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
Disaster.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue of Florida's gut.
And breakthrough moments.
Just let it sink in. An African American president of the United States of America.
4 decades are bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
Weekdays from noon to 2.
Sometimes it's well after the show that we start to get either people calling us and leaving messages on our talkback line or sending us email. But during the last segment when you were talking and right after we had our backyard quiz, we had a call from a Kauai listener who said that as far as our quiz on the Opaika Falls went, and as far as we had been talking about a little earlier today about safety for tourists and for ourselves, that maybe it would be a better idea not to hike down there, and was recalling some deaths in 2007 and just really urging caution and real attention to safety, even though it may be beautiful and luring and compelling, that it might be in everybody's best interest not to be going down to the falls. So there you go.
Well, in my news photography days, I covered enough rescues to know that hiking in Hawaii is a dicey proposition to be done with a certain amount of care and preparation and the right shoes.
Yeah, and if you're lucky, a lot of other calls to other people about where you're going and
exactly.
when you're expected back, too, so that at least there are some checks with that.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to say goodbye to you for this week, but coming with you next week to start it with the Martin Luther King Day holiday, and we'll continue our conversation, our ongoing conversation, with Cathedral of St. Andrew Dean, Walter Brownridge. Also, we'll catch up with the Republican Minority Caucus Representative Beth Fukumoto Chang will be here too.
And Jeanette Paulson-Heronico shares her life stories in her one-woman show, When Strangers Meet. You can email us at talkback@HawaiiPublicRadio and make comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation.
And if you'd like to know more about the show, go look on our website, hpr2.org.
Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich. Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant, and Caitlin Ikuma is our research assistant.
And appreciation to Mary Helen Gustafson, our special volunteer who spent her college vacation with us, and Casey Harlow for pinch hitting. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you Monday for The Conversation.